Am I still on? Good morning. My name is Tom. If we've not met, I'm one of the leaders here. If you stopped somebody on the street and asked, where do you go if you want to meet with God? What do you think they'd say? Find a church building? Go out for a nice walk in nature? Maybe somebody would say, nowhere. I don't think he's actually there. Exodus 19 is one of those passages in the Bible that shouts, the living God does meet with people. He comes down. He speaks. But as we're about to see, this isn't casual. It's wonderful and also a bit terrifying. And in the end, it raises a really massive question for us. How can ordinary people like us ever stand in the presence of a God like this? That's where our passage, that's what our passage is about this morning. And we've got lots to cover, so I'd like to invite Evelyn to come up and read the first section for us.
Okay. Exodus chapter 19. On the first day of the third month after the after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. After they settled from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That these are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned to the elders of the people and said before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has said. So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord.
Thanks, Evelyn. Well, there's quite a lot going on already in this passage, isn't there? We've got a time update to start, noting to the day exactly how long it's been since the Israelites left Egypt. But the author is keeping our attention on the desert experience of the Israelites. Not just the dramatic escape from Egypt, but the anti-climax of wandering around for weeks in the desert, looking for food, looking for water. And then they arrive at the foot of Mount Sinai. It's worth saying that this is a point in the narrative where everything slows down dramatically. To put things in perspective, the Israelites set up camp at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they stay put for the next 59 chapters of the Bible. Chronologically speaking, they're there for the next 10 months. This is a significant moment in the life of the people of Israel. Their relationship with God is going to transform in a profound way, and it begins with a revelation. A revelation. Look at verse 3. Moses goes to the mountain, and God gives him a message to relay to the people of Israel. It's a message specifically for them, which we just heard read out. And at this point, I want to underscore something that Ian said in his talk last week. Whatever else is happening in this passage, it's demonstrating two things. One, God is forming a people. And two, God is making his name known. This plays out in several ways in what the Lord tells Moses. It starts with a reminder. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. The Lord starts by appealing to very recent history, what the Israelites should know intuitively, but have demonstrably forgotten in their relatively short time wandering in the wilderness. We saw this a few weeks ago when they were testing God to try and get water, having only that morning eaten miraculously provided quail and manna. I think Matt called it unbelievable unbelief. Incidentally, don't get caught up on the on eagle's wings bit. Those of us who are a certain age remember The Rescuers Down Under, classic poorly regarded Disney or with fondness, or perhaps Lord of the Rings has some gigantic birds swooping in and saving the day. Is that what this is talking about? No, it's a metaphor. As unlikely as it would be for a bird of prey to swoop in and carry someone to safety, that's exactly how unlikely it would be for the Israelites to be freed from bondage. And notice verse 5 shifts the tone a little bit. It moves from remembrance to conditional language. Conditional language. He writes, "If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of the nations you will be my treasured possession." How does that strike you? Does it sound like maybe a recipe for legalism, a life of perpetually never knowing whether you've done enough, whether you're in or out with someone? In a vacuum, yeah, it could look like that, but we can't forget the verse before it, which is in effect summarizing the whole book before it. They've already been delivered. They aren't going to be saved and delivered by God on the basis of how well they follow his commands. They've already been saved and delivered for no other reason than they are his people who he loves. Have you ever been caught up in a sort of legalistic spiral? Thoughts like, I must not be good enough for God if the standard is perfection, so I might as well not bother with this whole Christianity thing. Look at this passage. Deliverance happens before obedience. Notice that the Lord doesn't leave it there. He carries on to say that his people will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Does this mean that everyone's going to walk around in priestly garments blessing everyone? No, that's not what I think the Lord's getting at here. First of all, notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say that they will be the mightiest of nations with a fully kitted out army who are going to strike fear into the hearts of their enemies when they turn up. He doesn't say that they'll be a wealthy nation covering everything they've got in gold and demonstrating their significance in a financial way. No, he zeroes in on kingdom of priests and holy nation. Several scholars writing on Exodus have shown how this is actually a clever turn on Moses' part to echo God's original purpose for humanity in the Garden of Eden. Bible scholar Desmond Alexander points out that kingdom of priests and holy nation is really God beginning to restore what was lost in Eden. Adam and Eve had direct access to God's presence and were commissioned to rule the world under him, and they lost that through disobedience. Here at Sinai, God is effectively saying to Israel, by walking in covenant faithfulness, you will begin to recover my original purpose for humanity. Now, I've also got this language of a holy nation. I think this is an expansion of the same idea. The word holy in the Bible carries lots of different connotations nowadays, but maybe the best definition we could use is holiness meaning set apart. The people of Israel are set apart, not as superior, but as distinctively belonging to God. What's intended here is that their life in community, their worship, their upholding of righteousness, justice, and equity, and the application of their laws, this is all intended to model and to reveal God to the nations around them. This people has a purpose. And this is the exact language that's picked up later on in the Bible in 1 Peter 2:9. Peter, remember, is one of Jesus' inner circle. He's writing to a bunch of ordinary, ethnically diverse, probably struggling Christians, and he calls them back to this scene. He says, "You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, God's special possession." That's the language he uses. The identity introduced at Mount Sinai is fulfilled in Jesus, not just for Israel, but for all who respond to Jesus' invitation. Come back to that in a little bit. One more thing to highlight here, because it's really important. The sort of language the Lord is using here, it's the language of a covenant. Now, you might have in mind a covenant being a sort of dry legal contract. I'm exchanging 3 sheep for a 1997 Nissan, something like that. Probably not. I don't think it's worth 3 sheep. Covenants in the Bible are far more personal. They're often intensely relational. Marriage is probably the best example. 2 people publicly bind themselves together, giving themselves over to the other fully, an expression of complete trust and loyalty. This is the kind of language that comes across when God talks about rescuing his people, carrying them on eagle's wings and binding himself to them in love. And like I said before, notice the order. The covenant doesn't begin with commands. Do this, and I'll love you. It begins with grace. Before God asks anything from Israel, he reminds them of the profound love he's already demonstrated. When he invites them to keep my covenant, he's not saying, earn my love. He's actually saying, live out the identity I've already given you. That's where this idea of a holy nation takes shape. They're meant to reflect God's character, the light of God's character in a dark world. And incidentally, this isn't something new. We saw how this was connected to Adam and Eve in the garden. It's also directly tied to Abraham. What does he say to Abraham? I will be your God, and you will be my people. But now it's not just a little family in a backwater town. It's a whole nation. And now the Lord tells his people how to prepare for his presence. And I'm going to invite Evelyn back up, and we're going to read verses 9 to 15.
Exodus 19, 9 to 15. The Lord said to Moses, I am going to come to you in a dense cloud, so that the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you. Then Moses told the Lord what the people had said. And the Lord said to Moses, come to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the 3rd day, because on that day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of the people. Put limits for all the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal shall be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast, may they approach the mountain. After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them, and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, prepare yourselves for the 3rd day. Abstain from sexual relations.
Thanks, Evelyn. You can think of this as a sort of formal announcement of a visit that will change everything. If we look at the ways in which the Hebrew Bible talks about God's presence, one of the most consistent things is that it's not just impressive, but it's downright intimidating. It really drives home the idea that the most frequent command in the Bible, does anyone know what the most frequent command in the Bible is? Don't be afraid. Yeah. This needs to be said so frequently should suggest to us the enormity of what's entailed with coming into God's presence. But notice why God is setting out to be present at Sinai in this way. The back half of verse 9, he says that this is so that people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you. In other words, he's coming down to this mountain at this time. The Lord himself will be guaranteeing that what Moses says about him is the true and right account. But at this point, we need to probably address the proverbial elephant in the room. One does not simply walk into the Lord's presence. What I mean here is that there's some preparation involved. Has anybody been in the presence of royalty? Anybody? A few? Here? A couple? Here and there? I have. It was kind of a wild experience. I was a student at Edinburgh University at the time when Princess Anne came by for a visit. This wasn't just a drop-in. We all received emails weeks before. They started painting all the corridors to make it look nicer than it did. The emails we got informed us of the standard protocol that we needed to follow. They told us there'd be extra security around, and while there wasn't a specific ban on wearing dinosaur t-shirts, it definitely felt implied. The list was fairly long. The royal approaches you, not the other way around. It's Your Royal Highness, followed by ma'am, as in jam. Don't try to take selfies with the princess, and so on and so on. Now, if these sorts of preparations go out for a human monarch, imagine how much more significant it must be to come into the presence of God, the creator and sustainer of all things. And it's worth noting that this is one of only a few points in the in this part of the Bible where God effectively says, stand back, I'm coming in person. It's both incredible and perhaps a touch intimidating. Now, the instructions he gives are pretty straightforward, if perhaps somewhat quirky in our modern eyes. Have a wash. Don't approach the mountain uninvited. Why these things? Is God recoiling at the sight of dirty laundry? No. In the culture, particularly where time and indeed water were precious commodities, it was a sign of the utmost respect to intentionally and specifically wash all your clothes. This underscored all the more by the reality that they're in the middle of a desert. So presumably either this washing happened with the limited supply of water they were carrying with them, or hundreds of thousands of people had to take turns washing in the little stream nearby. Either way, it makes sense that it takes several days to get everyone ready. And what's this about not approaching the mountain? Why go to the extent of threatening capital punishment for those who don't take the command seriously? I think we need to unpack a bit more about the nature of God's holiness here. The illustration I thought of is, think of it a bit like the sun. The sun gives life to everything on earth. It's essential to our existence and our survival. But we can't just walk up to it. If you tried, you'd have a pretty bad experience. It's actually so powerful you can't stare at it directly. It's so powerful you need to slather yourself in goo so that it doesn't cook you when you go to the beach. The sun is blazing. It's brilliant. It's powerful. It invokes awe, but it's powerful at a level that we can't possibly fathom, let alone experience unfiltered. God is here saying that at his holy mountain, approaching his presence is by invitation only. This isn't God being difficult. It's God demonstrating his holiness. His holiness is life-giving, and yet, if approached wrongly, could be lethal at the same time. So they do what the Lord says. They wash up their clothes. They stay away from the mountain. Verse 15 also notes they abstain from sex. Does this mean that sex is somehow ungodly? Absolutely not. God created sex, after all. I think it's more helpful to think of this as one part of a wider preparation for something special, something different in the life of every Israelite person. The commentator Douglas Stewart has a helpful passage on this. He writes, "Does this verse imply that having sex is evil? Not at all. Rather, it asserts that there are special occasions of prayerful preparation and worshipful activity that call for an avoidance of the usual, non-sinful personal indulgences and demand special, focused, self-denying attention to God." So this isn't God inflicting some prudish attitude towards sex and sexuality in his people. Think of it a bit more like fasting. At various times in the Bible, God's people are instructed to take a short break from their regular routine. And there are moments in your life where you will say, this thing deserves my full, uninterrupted attention. This is one of those moments. So for 2 days, the people wash, they wait, they abstain, and they stay back from the mountain. Every ordinary part of life is put on pause. Distractions are removed. The camp gets quiet. There's a stillness. There's a sense of anticipation before the presence of God arrives. And then, on the morning of the third day, the quiet of the preparation is utterly shattered. There's thunder, there's lightning, there's smoke, a whole mountain shaking. Sound like a trumpet blast from heaven. The God who reveals himself in words is about to reveal himself in fire. Let's listen to what happens.
Exodus chapter 19, 16 to 25. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning, with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. When Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain, Mount Sinai was covered with smoke, because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. As the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. The Lord descended to the top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. So Moses went up, and the Lord said to him, go down and warn the people so they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord will break out against them. Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up Mount Sinai, because you yourself warned us. Put limits around the mountain and set it apart as holy. The Lord replied, go down and bring Aaron up with you. But the priest and the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them.
Thank you, Evelyn. I think these chapter-long talks are really a lot of extra work for our Bible readers. Thank you so much. Well, in a sense, this is the moment that our whole time in Exodus has been building up to. The Lord has remembered his people. He's delivered his people, and now he's coming to be with his people. We had revelation, we had preparation. Now it's time for manifestation, the Lord's presence near his people. And look at the language that the chapter uses. Thunder and lightning, thick cloud over the mountain, a loud trumpet blast. The whole mountain shakes as God descends to meet Moses. It's not a gentle ephemeral spiritual encounter. It's terrifying and it's wonderful all at once, because this is not just the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is the creator of everything, breaking into the physical world in holiness and majesty. We see creation itself responding to his presence. And then notice what happens. God calls Moses back up the mountain, but there's a warning. He says, warn the people so they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Even now, after 2 days of washing, consecrating, abstaining, waiting, people can't come closer. There's a boundary in place. The mediator, Moses, goes up, but the people have to stay back. This is a huge moment in the storyline of the Bible. God is drawing near, but full access to his presence is not yet possible. We've seen revelation, there's been preparation, we're actively seeing the manifestation of God's physical presence, But a physical distance remains. So Moses obeys. He goes up the mountain. The Israelites stay back. God is about to reveal the Ten Commandments, the law that will shape Israel's life, identity, worship, justice, and relationships for centuries. And it's a cliffhanger. You can feel the story holding its breath, waiting for what's to come. And I'm afraid you're going to have to wait till we pick this up in the new year. But before we go, we need to recognize what this scene at the foot of Mount Sinai was preparing us for. Because it's not just an ancient story. It's a preview of a greater mountain, a greater revelation, a greater manifestation of God's presence with his people, and that comes through another mediator. You see, the writer to the book of the Hebrews says this. He writes that Christians in the decade after Jesus' death, he says, "You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm." And look where he goes with it. "You've come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, to God, the judge of all, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant." And this is a game changer. God descended on Sinai in fire, but he's come even closer to us, not in a mountain, but in a person, Jesus. It's Jesus who will be the final mediator between God and humanity. But there are some key differences here. This mediator doesn't need to go up and down the mountain again and again. He's in perfect relationship with his Father. His suffering rips apart the final boundary between God and his people. He's a mediator who brings us joy and wholeness rather than fear. Sinai shows us the holiness of God. Calvary, where Jesus died, shows us the way to full relationship with God. At Sinai, the people said, "Don't let God speak to us or we'll die." At Calvary, we have the Savior who said, "Come unto me and I'll give you rest." At Sinai, the people washed their clothes. At Calvary, Jesus washes their whole selves, their hearts, their consciences, their guilt. At Sinai, the people had to stay back. But at Calvary, Jesus made a way once and for all for his people to draw near to God. Is this your hope? Is this your identity? Not in your accomplishments, your education, your bank balance, but in Jesus who came to put you right with God forever? I hope it is. If not, and you'd like to talk about it, please talk to one of us who's been up at the front. We'd love to speak with you. As the musicians come up, I'm going to end by saying that Hebrews 12 goes on to say, "Since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe." In other words, when you see the God of Sinai and the grace of Jesus together, the right response is grateful, reverent worship. So let's sing about this new identity we have in Jesus and what it means for us.